Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Hunt Stand. Hunt Stand is the number one hunting app in the country, and at only $29.99, Hunt Stand offers a ton of functionality for hunters all over the country. Whether you own your own property or strictly hunt public, you can choose from over a dozen base maps, view property ownership information, 3D mapping, local weather, log your sightings and harvest, as well as use their trail cam management software, and print maps from your hunt areas. Download it today at the Apple App Store or Google Play. Hunt Stand. Upgrade your arsenal.
You're listening to the Average Conservationist Podcast, brought to you by Go Hunt and in partner with 2% for Conservation. Sign up today to become an insider at gohunt.com. 2% for Conservation's mission is to create an alliance of businesses and individuals that ensure the future of hunting and angling by committing their time and dollars to fish and wildlife. 1% of your time plus 1% of your money equals 2% for conservation. 2% helps businesses and people pair with conservation causes to support things that fit what they care about. Whether you're into fishing, hunting, or just getting outdoors, 2% can help you not only start giving back to wildlife, but get certified for it. Getting 2% certified means you've made the same commitments as popular brands like Sitka, First Light, Stone Glacier, and Seek Outside in giving at least 1% of your time and dollars back to wildlife. But it's not just for outdoor companies. Breweries, contractors, coffee roasters, and even piano repair companies have earned 2% certification and stand out as leaders in their community for doing so. Businesses that are committed to conservation deserve your business when you shop. Learn more about 2% for Conservation at fishandwildlife.org. That's fishandwildlife.org. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. I hope that everyone enjoyed their Thanksgiving holiday with friends and family. And if you're fortunate enough, got to spend some time outdoors in the process. Welcome back to the Average Conservationist Podcast, and I'm your host, Marcus Ewing. Today on the podcast, I am joined by John Sepp and Brittany Masters, and they are the co-owners and co-founders of Roam Free Bison Ranch in Montana. And this is a really cool story because kind of on a quick side note, There's a separate podcast I listen to pretty regularly, and some of the recent guests on that podcast have been ranchers, either from Montana or Colorado, and just the ranching industry, the ranching business is something that I know very little about. So when I scheduled the podcast with John and Brittany, I was super excited because it's something I've been listening to a lot, and to be able to kind of pick their brain and understand, you know, why a bison ranch and, you know, what their mission is and what their goal is. And we talk a lot about regenerative agriculture and the practices that they use on the ranch there. And, you know, what exactly that means and how that is beneficial to the herd, to the land, to everything involved in the entire process. We also get to talk about John and Brittany's background and how they cross paths and how kind of from the outside looking in, it's I don't want to say an unusual pairing, but if you look at their backgrounds, you know, prior to the ranch and really where they're at now, it's pretty interesting and it's pretty cool to see how they have come together and really have this thriving business there in Montana. So really, I ask a ton of questions because I'm super curious, as I mentioned, about, you know, the whole process. And I think that that maybe there's a misconception out there about, you know, what ranch life looks like. And, you know, I don't know that people really value and appreciate, you know, all the work that, you know, whether it's a cattle ranch, a bison ranch, what have you, you know, the importance of that part of kind of Americana, really. So episode 79, John and Brittany, Roam Free Bison Ranch. Enjoy. Before that, though, I want to take a minute to tell you about Wild Rivers Coffee. And if you haven't had a chance to try Wild Rivers Coffee by now, come on, guys. Let's get to it, because you guys are really missing out on a stellar cup of coffee and supporting conservation in the process. Wild Rivers Coffee, they're roasting in small batches so that they can ensure your coffee arrives at its peak freshness. Wild Rivers Coffee is also a proud partner with 2% for Conservation. They believe in preserving the wild places and wild things that bring all of us a ton of joy. So that's why with everything they sell, a portion of the proceeds are being donated back to conservation organizations that are near and dear to them. So head over to wildriverscoffeeco.com and get your fresh roasted beans. They have some really cool handmade mugs. The merchandise is awesome. I own both of their shirts. They have a ton of accessories for, you know, brewing your coffee, for pour over, anything that you can need to kind of fulfill your coffee dreams, I guess they have. So definitely be sure to check them out. And while you're there, if you want, use the code, this is all caps, fish_wildlife, and you're going to save 10% off your order. But now through December 21st, they are running a promo that if you spend $75 or more, you are going to get a free bag of coffee of your choice on them. So all you have to do is add some stuff to your cart, a couple, you know, t-shirt, a couple bags of coffee, whatever. Hit that $75 mark and then add a bag of coffee to your cart. And then when you go to checkout, it's going to show you that it's a free bag for their holiday promo. Now, the last day you can do that, December 21st, to ensure that that coffee arrives to you before Christmas. So again, check out wildriverscoffeeco.com. All right, joining me on the podcast today, I have the owners of 2% Certified Roam Free Bison Ranch, John Sepp and Brittany Masters. Guys, how are you?
Doing good.
Good.
Doing good on a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah. With the time difference here, I had made a mistake, obviously, when I sent over the calendar invite, and your colleague Rick had reached out today. So, I mean, it's, you know, almost 9 o'clock here, so don't mind me. I have certainly cracked a beer for this conversation. So
I will match a beer with just a nice red wine. So, same.
Perfect. Well, guys, we kind of talked about it before we started recording, and just I'm really excited. You guys are the first ranch that's 2% certified, being a bison ranch. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that I kind of really want to get into. I'm going to apologize ahead of time if I seem to kind of go off the rails a little bit, just asking a lot of questions, because it's all just very new to me and very interesting to me. So I'm certainly excited to speak.
Yeah, ask away. Yeah. We're happy to answer anything.
Awesome. So I guess first, let's just start with the business. So tell me exactly like what Roam Free Bison Ranch is and what it is that you guys do.
Yeah, so we are a regenerative bison ranch. Right now we raise bison and then we process them into a variety of different value-added meat products. So we have a jerky, a chili, and a sous vide that we're coming out with. We have different meat snacks. And then we sell fresh and frozen meat as well, locally into some restaurants, things like that.
So did either of you grow up ranching?
No.
No, neither of us did. I started the ranch before I met Brittany. My dad was in the military, and so I grew up mostly in Norway. But when I was really young, we moved all over the United States, and I saw bison when I was really young, like 4 or 5. And so when I got older, I'd always wanted to engage in raising them. And I thought at first it was just going to be a hobby, but later it turned into a commercial venture. And then I met Brittany, and she's really the one that helped to accelerate our marketing and, build a voice for the business. And together, that's where we built the value-added products that we're bringing to market, rather than just entertaining the ranching, portion venture of the business.
So, Brittany, what was your path to get to Roam Free?
Windy? I don't know. So, really, I mean, I had worked in brand marketing in the Seattle area for 10 years or so for a large aviation manufacturer. Some people might know it. But and I had worked with airlines and travel companies, and I was just really into health. So I didn't have a background in it, but I was just I was passionate about nutrition and where our food comes from. And basically I met John, and we obviously started a relationship, and he was just at the time looking to sell his bison ranch and move to Seattle. And, he didn't want to sell it. It was one of these things where he had done really all the hard work in building it, but was having trouble getting his product to market in a efficient way, especially with logistics around meat processing. And I was just looking for another opportunity to really dive into my passion of nutrition. And so basically he took me out to Montana and said, before I sell it, let's go spend a, weekend at the ranch. And I fell in love with Montana and this place. And, we realized there's absolutely no way we're going to let this dream go. And I basically decided to quit my job, and John decided to quit his other job and go full time into bison ranching. And that's how basically Roam Free was started, was a business end of the ranch to really sell products in an effort to save the ranch.
So what is the time frame on this? So I guess first, John, when did you, first start dabbling with bison on your own prior to meeting Brittany?
Yeah, so I started about 9 years ago.
Okay.
I had served for 9 years in the military prior to that. But that whole time had the plan that I was going to leave my military career to do this, to engage in this. And most of that plan just entailed saving money. To start a ranch just requires a lot of cash input. So I saved most of that time through the military. And so when I exited, I was able to find an affordable spot here in Montana. And so that's the time frame. And then about 5 years after starting that is when I met Brittany. And so we've had the business
5 years in July.
5 years now. So yeah, I guess it's been a total of 10 years.
Okay.
Time flies.
Time flies. Yep.
Well, I guess before we go any further, excuse me, I forgot to mention earlier, but you know, certainly thank you for your service, John, and the time that you spent in the military there.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It's my pleasure. I was spending all the tax dollars, so it was totally my fault. Yeah.
So I guess kind of take me through the process of, you know, once, Brittany, once you got involved, you know, with the ranch, you know, what that transition looked like or how you were kind of able to help get things to market a little bit better. Because, John, as you mentioned, you know, the process or the just the whole process of getting the meat to market to, you know, however the case is. I mean, how difficult was that or what does that process look like, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, so really John had done all of the hard work. So Bill, you know, selecting a property, saving, I mean, he lived on a flight line in a trailer for 9 years just to be able to afford the down payment for a piece of land. And, you know, had built a house, a barn, and fenced the entire property by hand, got the bison out here, had a corral system built, and, you know, thought that really the selling and the marketing end of it would come naturally. It would be really easy. But when you start with such a few amount of animals, which is, you know, we started with only 9 animals, you go to a restaurant and they want maybe a tenderloin, a New York, a ribeye. Basically 15% of the animal is really highly valued. And then what do you do with the rest of the animals and how do you get enough cash flow to be able to buy more so you can get more tenderloins and New Yorks and ribeyes? And, you know, so when we talked about it, John had been making, you know, jerky on the side a bit and had a few recipes. And I had been primarily my job, I spent traveling 50-75% of my time internationally in places where I didn't really trust the meat sources there or didn't know what could possibly be in the food I was eating. And so I was making my own jerky and bringing it with me, basically. And so we sort of put our heads together and came up with a product that used the whole animal. So for small business or small ranchers that are selling direct to market, whole carcass utilization is sort of the buzzword that we throw around, but it's basically making the best use of the entire animal, so that you can afford to buy more and keep going. And so we came up with the chopped and formed product that used the majority of the animal. And that's, and it also as a jerky product, it have a 12-month shelf life, really gave us enough kind of leeway to be able to brand our product and get to market efficiently. And then from there is once we had that under control is where we started branching out with these new products. But we had to sort of lay the groundwork first.
Yeah, I mean, that's that makes complete sense, like as you kind of lay it out like that, right? Like you have obviously the prime cuts of the bison that everyone's going to want, you know, but you still have this very, very large animal with a lot of very edible, good meat, right? So what do you do with it? And yeah, kind of the route that you took. So John, you kind of listed them off earlier, but I forgot, I didn't quite get them written down. So you have jerky. What else do you guys have?
Yeah, we have, chopped and formed jerky, a whole muscle jerky product, which is a totally different way of fabricating jerky. It's more traditional style. So we view that as a separate product line. Sorry, that was our dog.
It's all right.
Bison chili, and then a stew product, which is, you know, potatoes, carrots, and bison meat in a sous vide mix, which is essentially just a way of cooking meat.
Right.
Where you're familiar with what it is, it's really a way of cooking meat for wild game, and so it's perfect for bison.
Yeah, and so a lot of these products are being launched real time. So we actually launched the chili and the stew in January 7th, actually. So, premature, but it'll be exciting.
Yeah, no, that certainly is exciting. So, I guess, John, you know, starting the ranch, Brittany, you mentioned that he had started with nine bison. What are you guys up to now?
This spring we'll turn over about 200.
Wow.
And then we just acquired, we're working on building up another property to finish the bison on. It's an irrigated pasture where we can probably finish about 100 more yearlings coming 2-year-olds. So, you know, we'll end up purchasing a second seed herd to put into there this coming spring. And then we're always looking at trying to get more leases on top of that.
Yeah. Okay. So I've like I said, I'm going to kind of go off course here. I just have a ton of questions. So one, you mentioned it earlier that you guys are a regenerative ranch, or you have regenerative practices. I've heard that before. I have an idea what it means. But instead of me trying to kind of ask, oh, is this what it is? And being completely off base. Why don't you kind of tell me like what that is? Because it seems to be a practice that I'm seeing more and more in ranching.
Yeah. It's a, you know, there's a lot to it, but to put it simply, you know, the concept is you are improving the ground that you're ranching on year over. And what that looks like is building topsoil, which increases the amount of grass, which increases your moisture retention on it, has a lot of beneficial effects. And the way that you accomplish that with large ruminants is, you know, meaning bison, is you cell graze them, or you graze them in based on bloom cycles of grasses. You know, we have different elevations on the ranch. We have all these different pastures that we've built. You build tons of fence, you know, across the ranch. We've got over 120 miles of fence that we built to contain them in this system. And you move them pasture to pasture to fresh grass to enact the way bison once were moved by wolves. And really what that does over a long period of time is allows grass to recover, but activate its emergency system that causes its roots to spread out, and you get more over every year. And the process of doing that, really, to put it even more simply, was, you know, pre-settlement of the central part of the United States, bison were moved around by wolves and tribal hunters and seasonalities, and all that movement and the way that bison herd together in a very tight group created all that topsoil that all the corn and wheat and everything is grown on in the United States. It's the fertility of all the soil in North America was created by bison. And so you're just building up an intensive grazing system on a ranch to mimic that.
Okay. That actually makes complete sense. So like from a grazing standpoint, like, and you know, moving them from pasture to pasture, like how long is that like phase? Let's say, you know, if they're called pasture A before they, you know, move on to pasture B, right? Like is it like a couple days or a couple weeks?
That is a great question. It completely varies depending on grass type, the water available, you know, different grasses grow at different elevations. So your elevation, like the whole ranch has more than a couple thousand feet difference in elevation just across one of the main ranches.
Oh, wow.
And so depending on all of that, we carefully structure our pastures based on our local, you know, topography and grass structure to rotate them. So some they're longer, some they're in a couple weeks, some they're only in 3 days, some they might be in a month, you know. And if it's over winter time and your grass is lignifying and dying, going dead, you know, you might want to spread them out more. Or if they're calving, sometimes they're going to want to spread out, and so you don't necessarily want to have them so close together. You want to allow them to have space to naturally spread out like they would. So you're going to put them into a bigger pasture for that period of time. So it really depends on the time of year. But on average, I'd say you're looking at about a week per pasture is what we try to aim for on average. But of course, totally depending where you're at in the year on that.
Yeah. Wow. And to, I mean, that's I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about it, right? Like ranching is a 24/7, 365 job, right? Like there's no, I don't feel like getting out of bed this morning. I don't feel good, right? Like the bison need to eat or they need to be moved around. Like it seems like there's always something to do. How is it that I guess you got so deep into it, right? I mean, you mentioned, as a young kid, you always had a kind of a fascination with them and you wanted to get involved with them. I mean, I guess, how do you go from 9 to, to over 200 heads in really such a short amount of time, in my opinion?
Well, they breed, so they make babies. That's one way. But really, the answer to that is I was fascinated with the animal first. I just loved them. I loved the shape of them. I liked their history as I got older. I mean, I'm still very fascinated with just how it came to be. We went from tens of millions to less than 300 to now we're back to about 200,000 in just the United States. And, it's a major comeback story. Everybody likes that. But how did we get so into all of this? And the regenerative part of it was really when I first started, my lack of experience and all this money I had saved led me to buy a very unproductive piece of dry pasture land. And, it was in a gulch. We live, the road that runs through the ranch is Wilkes Gulch. It's not a good spot. And so I'm not going to say I was duped, but I didn't know better. And so when you're starting, you just don't know what you don't know. I didn't have generational knowledge to rely on. And so you just think open space, ground, Now, of course, we look much more carefully at everything that we buy and lease and move everything on. But, I realized very quickly that I'd run out of room and really run out of grass on the property. The first property I bought was just 240 acres. And, so that felt like a lot then, and that probably sounds like a lot to somebody, but that's not a lot of ground and not a lot for this area of Montana and what you're really going to want for bison. So when I first put him out there, I had no interior fencing. I kind of had no plan. I was just trying to go for like zoo containment. I built the Jurassic Park, release the animals, and, hopefully it all goes okay. And so I was just trying to keep them in with step one because I was also learning animal husbandry. How do they work? What is their seasonality and how does their behavior change in that? But ultimately, the reality of needing to make the ranch work and make money came into play. And so, as you learn those things, you look for how do you optimize, how do you have greater efficiency? And really, I was at a conference long time ago, and some they didn't call it regenerative agriculture at the time. It was there's so many different names, holistic management, or that was really what it was called then. And before that, it was rotational grazing. But as time has moved forward, they keep calling it something new, but really it's the same concept, just with tighter and tighter pasture grouping, right? And technology and fencing and things improves that allows us to do that. And so I was. When somebody says, hey, I can get 30% better pasture utilization, meaning you can fit 30% more animals on your pasture if you do this. Well, I had time to do that and I needed to do it because I needed to survive when I heard that. And so I invested a lot of my time in learning a lot of those concepts early on. And so that eventually led into what people now call regenerative, which is just, in my opinion, a slightly more complex version of that, where you're not just, you take all those same concepts of rotational grazing, but you're trying to apply as much science and insight as you possibly can. And that's still developing, and ecologists are still learning new things about the environment and grass and animal interaction every day. And so as those things come about, we're trying to adapt all of those theories and lessons into what it is that we're doing. And you try it and you see if it works or not. But it takes you time to do that. And so that's how we got into it. And so we've just been practicing that intensively since pretty much the beginning. And when I met Brittany was really when we went big. I had 240 acres. We had built this value added product. You know, we took a huge step back and pretty much just locked ourselves in and only dealt with the animals that we had for 6 months. We built this brand, we built a product, and we launched it. We traveled all around the United States promoting it. And before we knew it, within about a month, we were completely sold out. So, you know, then we had the problem of, we knew how to optimize ground, we knew how to make it efficient, but now we needed more animals to build more product so we could build the business. And that was the point where we sought larger leases, and that's really where the ranch took off. And that was 5 years ago. And so that's when we made the jump from 240 acres to then we jumped up to 10,000 acres. And then we jumped to 13,000, then 14,000. And recently we lost a big lease, but, you know, it just kept snowballing and building into more land and more animals and more fencing, really, is what it was. So,
yeah, I mean, that's certainly a jump from 240 acres to, you know, 10,000. To try to quantify that amount of land in my head is just, it's really incredible. I mean, and obviously when you think about a herd of 200 bison and, you know, moving from pasture to pasture, every, you know, 5, 7, maybe 10, 14 days. I mean, you need all that space, right? You need to have, the room, available to allow that to be effective.
Yeah. And especially here, I mean, just dry land pasture in general, you want more ground. I mean, and we do more than just trying to optimize what's already there. You know, really our ultimate goal is, you know, to really be regenerative is to encourage native grass to grow back. Just meaning grasses that bison and their rumen naturally do well on and that naturally benefit the landscape. So you can grow more interspersed grass, you have higher, you know, efficiencies, and environmentally, of course, that's much better as well. So if somebody looks at it from that angle, it's good from all angles. And the protein complex that it creates in an animal and in bison, in my opinion, when they eat it, it makes it taste better. I don't know about the health of it, but I could assume that if an animal is, you know, eating what they're supposed to be, you know, their version of a whole food diet, it's going to make them healthier as well. So, and thus you too, you know, if you're eating it. So that's really what we work towards ultimately in our regenerative process, is trying to transplant a lot of work that a lot of people did with the USDA and the government around, you know, World War II. We had a huge program to transplant grass in the United States and even pre-World War II. But really, that was where a lot of the, you know, we were trying to cut corners to feed protein to people. And you could sacrifice that by, you know, in a very simplistic way, exchanging grass seed that overtook native grasses, turning over soil and allowing the stalk and stem of the grass to have, you know, you plant grasses that are not native to the United States that grow up higher in the stalk and stem and less in the root, whereas native grasses grow much deeper in the root and they have very short, usually they're shorter grasses. And that big transplant that happened in the United States is good, I think, if you're raising cows and trying to transplant that and you need a grass that sticks above snow in the winter, and there's all sorts of benefits that you can gain from that. But our opinion is that's a short-term gain. We're looking at the long-term goal. And so we try to, whether it be through reseeding or there's ways that you can graze out a lot of those non-domestic grasses during the year, we try to target that and force those grasses down to encourage native grass growth again. And ultimately it makes your ranch more drought resistant, the bison do better, and the health of the consumer goes up.
Yeah. So what is the, I guess the, call it the life cycle of, you know, from the time you receive a bison till like the harvesting? I mean, what is a mature bison look like for you guys?
A grass-fed bison is going to grow much slower than if you're feeding it other or cow or really any animals, they're just going to grow slower than if you're feeding it a compressed starch and like a grain. And so typically a 30-month animal is prime, what we consider prime. But the way that we built our products, we don't require prime animals. And so we can really use an animal of any age in there. And so at some point, the bones start to outgrow the additional muscle that the animal can gain in its lifetime. I mean, bison can live to be 30 years old or more sometimes, but there's a happy medium in there of toughness and a whole bunch of, you know, different qualifying factors that would, you know, based on, you know, its gender or, you know, maybe some of its health history, those types of things that help us make the decision on what really we want to use in a product.
Yeah. So Brittany, obviously you kind of came in, or you met John, you know, 5 years into this endeavor for him. So how difficult was it for you to kind of catch up from a, you know, just a sheer knowledge standpoint of the animal and the practices and all that stuff, you know, to, you know, really feel comfortable, you know, with, you know, with the business?
I'm still catching up. I'm still learning stuff from John every single day. I mean, John, if you spend any time with us, you know, John is a details guy. He loves history and really diving into the details. And, you know, he's a electrical engineer by trade from his education. So he's just really analytical. And I'm more top line, you know, working on the marketing and the creative aspects. And, you know, I like to sort of try to get the simple answer. And sometimes it's just not simple. You know, it's really dynamic. And I think that was my biggest misconception about ranching when I came into it, that ranching, it's a simple life, right? It should be really easy. And you just feed and water and harvest. And it's just anything but that. It's really, really dynamic and always changing. And there's a lot of science behind, you know, just what we do in practice. So,
yeah. So what does a typical day look like for you guys? I mean, if you have 10,000 acres, I mean, I've got to imagine that just putting in fence is you have to have like a full-time crew just to keep up with that, right?
It's a full-time crew. Yeah, it's basically from when the snow melts to when the ground freezes, John and his crew are putting in new fence, and then the other months they're repairing the fence.
Yeah.
From elk or deer or, you know, other animals that have crossed it.
Yeah, and keeping a map of, you know, over 100 miles of fence, and it's all electric fence. So, you know, we try to build circuits, which it's unusual to build that much electric fence for any ranch. But, you know, it's a lot of work to keep all those circuits up. We run a simultaneous hot and ground system on our fence. You know, it's a 5-wire. And so what that really means is if you have a tree fall on it or an elk crosses it or a deer gets tangled in it or something happens and you have a short in the fence, that one short over all those miles, depending on how many chargers you have in there, can take down anywhere from 4 to 20 miles of fence at a time. And so we're always kind of on alert, trying to stay on it. It is like Jurassic Park, you know, except they're not dinosaurs. You know, that part sometimes gets exaggerated with bison, you know. They are aggressive animals, but, you know, they will find out if your fence is off. They're so smart. And so it's just a constant game of cat and mouse chasing shorts in the fence to keep it up. So we spend a lot of time doing that. And of course, building new fence. We have a full-time fencing crew and operation business that we've built just to sustain this business. So we run that in tandem. And we'll have anywhere from 4 to 12 hands working just on the fence crew full time, from spring till winter.
So how many do you employ there at the ranch? I guess just, you know, total.
It's totally seasonal, but, you know, we'll have, we have a lot of volunteers actually that come out, people that are interested either in learning the regenerative part or the ranching part fencing or bison. So that usually makes up about half our crew. And then the other half are, you know, paid skilled hands. And so, you know, this summer, I think we had 9 people out there, maybe 10, 9 or 10 people full time. But it kind of, you know, waxes and wanes with the seasons. Winter is slower, it's more sustainment, and you need people that have that map in their head that know how to get to all the fence that we build. Where we're building is in very, very difficult areas. You wouldn't normally be building electric fence. You know, it's either very steep or rocky through trees, you know, across streams, those types of things. Those can be very difficult areas to build through, but then also maintain. So we really rely heavily on our skilled hands to keep, you know, keep that map and keep those fences up. And if you haven't built it, it is just a maze. You will get lost, and it's very hard to hand that map over to anybody, even if I draw it. So,
yeah. So I guess, what would you say, you know, throughout this entire process, right? So, you know, the 10 years that you've been involved with bison, involved with ranching, you know, is there anything that you look back over your time and you kind of say to yourself, I wish I would have done this differently, you know, knowing what I know now? Or do you think, you know, it's everything happens for a reason, you know, something happens, whether it's good or bad, you know, you learn from it, you move on. But is there, you know, anything you would have done differently?
Background checks on volunteers. but other than that, I mean, I really enjoyed the ups and downs. Everything is difficult, but you learn something out of everything you do. You know, I feel like everything that we've done has built either a good story or good character or something in us. And so I don't regret, you know, the struggle along the way. And I think the struggle makes for a more authentic product, and you connect better with consumers. And, you know, people recognize that you can't fake that. And that struggle is, I think, what people romanticize, but, you know, about ranching. And it's a privilege to get to live that in some senses. But, you know, then other times you don't say that when you're cussing and it's negative 40 and, you know, you have 20 miles of fence to walk through in the snow. Because
when you really are struggling. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's easy to say that now sitting in the house talking to you, but, you know, it's just, it ebbs and flows, and it's what you choose. And I don't know, I wouldn't choose anything different now that we've done that and we've made it through it. It's very rewarding, but we certainly wanted to quit many times along the way. And changing all that at the beginning, I don't think would have, you wouldn't develop the skill set to fix all the stuff and make it operate like it does now. You couldn't operate a huge network of fence if you didn't learn all those little details along the way.
Yeah, and I'd have to imagine that, you know, a company, or not a company, but an occupation, a lifestyle of a rancher, and what we talked about earlier with, you know, really no days off, I mean, that hardens a person to the point where I got to imagine it's going to take a whole hell of a lot to get either of you guys to quit anything. Right. I mean, I don't care if it's, you know, going out for a run, doing some push-ups, you know, whatever the case is, right? Whatever you want to kind of embark on. Like, I can't really imagine either one of you guys having that mindset that, oh, this is hard. I think I'm just going to stop now.
We are all in.
Yeah.
We've never been more all in on anything. I mean, it is not, there's no going backwards for us. And we've, you know, we've been in the thick of it, feeling like we're going to lose it all, you know, over silly mistakes, and we'll do anything to keep this moving forward.
Yeah.
So is there a lot of other bison ranches that are, you know, that have like this same, or that are practicing the regenerative feeding?
There are. Definitely, you know, yeah. I think it really depends on how far somebody gets into that, to say how deep into the weeds do you want to be before you call it regenerative. But I think I like to say it this way. Bison in general, when you compare them as a species, and this is not to get down on beef producers, everybody struggles in the snow here. So yeah. I respect everybody that ranches. And even if you choose to have a feedlot, I have respect for those people too. You know, it's a lifestyle and they're doing what they want to do and what they think is right. And I think that's a great part about being in this country and the freedom to choose what you want. So take all that. and when I say with what I say next, which is, in general, my opinion is bison in themselves as a species are regenerative. If you go out and you look at a field of bison and you look at a field of cows next to them, right, which is really where people make the comparison, right? Cows tend to be very spread out, right? You could have you could look at a 1,000-acre pasture and they'd be pretty much, unless there's water in there and it's a hot day, they're going to be pretty well evenly distributed across that pasture. Now, if you go and you look at bison in that same pasture, generally, they're going to be grouped in a very tight little tiny group. And we build all that fencing to mimic wolves, keeping them close by, them wanting to move as a group to have like protection against predators. Even if you didn't build all that fencing to go over the top to the next level, you're still going to naturally have a regenerative effect on land with bison. And that's nobody can argue with. That was the animal that built all the topsoil with those natural instincts. That natural wild instinct is what built all that soil with those movements and the way that they group together. And so I hope that answers that.
They're
just naturally regenerative.
I mean, you can be more regenerative. There's always things you can do to improve and be, you know, more regenerative, if you will, or sequester more carbon. But at the end of the day, bison are pretty much the keystone species of the prairie, and they help keep, you know, it true to what it is.
Yeah, and it's not to say you can't do that with cows. A lot of people have regenerative beef ranches, and so they do the same thing. They just have to build more fence, or they work harder to keep them grouped together to really, it's that grouping at a very high level that allows you to have that effect on grass and land.
So this is, I'm curious to hear your opinion, your guys' opinion on this. So if the bison hadn't went through what they went through in terms of, you know, the market hunting and all that, and the, you know, entire population, like you said, John, getting down to, you know, less than 300 at one point, mm-hmm. what do you think that would have potentially done for, you know, agriculture across the country, you know, if that population that was here early on had been, you know, even, you know, half as sustained as unfortunate, you know, as what it was when with the market hunting and everything. I mean, what would that have done? Would that just have created, you know, more farmable land and soil? I mean, what's kind of your opinion on that?
Well, I have two opinions. You can't undo what's already been done. So it's hard to think about that, right? Mm-hmm. But say we had a magic wand and it was that way. First off, everybody and their mother and every minivan on the highway would be getting in an accident every day. They don't move for anything. You know, they are, you know, there's a lot of controversy just in Montana, even about, you know, people saying like wild bison herds should be allowed to roam out. Well, it's actually not a super great idea. You're going to have a lot of destruction and disaster for a way of infrastructure and the way people have just built fences, even for beef ranches, or highways have been built, or cities or towns. You know, you would have a very hard time trying to let bison around that infrastructure exist now as is. Now, had you gone back and your infrastructure was totally looked different and it was all bison proofed, if you will, you know, and brought that forward over the last 100 years, then maybe you could have had a system. But they require a lot of range to move about. You know, they naturally migrate, they chase a green wave that comes out, they have natural corridors that they would go to for breeding grounds, where that you'd have a big northern and a southern herd and they'd meet up really here in Montana, and a lot of genetic exchange would happen, and that was super important. And then they kind of split up and go their separate ways as the seasons changed. It would be so hard to have our country around that now. Would it if I could make it that way, would it be that way? I think it would be awesome to see what that would look like, but I just don't think it's practical. It's just not practical to have that and be a leading efficient nation in the world with our highway network and everything set up. So the best thing that we can do now is to try to preserve what we have and improve on the pastures that are existing, keeping those open. I think that's really the battle that we're facing now. And it doesn't matter if you have bison or beef or anything. Really, you're facing, you know, what Europe faced a long time ago is just people spreading out because of COVID, moving to rural areas, thinking they want two chickens and a goat, and chopping up these heritage ranches that have been protected for a long time, you know, since settlement of, you know, colonization to the United States. And, you know, that's the battle that we're facing now. You know, if you want to look at it from a conservation or what we like to call a preservation standpoint, that I think is brass tacks where there needs to be action taken to do the best with what we have and to stop, to slow that process, because it's inevitable. You know, it will happen. People want to spread out, and that's happened significantly, in, as we've seen in the last 2 years, just in Montana here. Everybody moved here amidst COVID, and land prices have shot up. It's a disaster, you know, not just for ranchers, but in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was, when you were telling me how, you know, where you started at, you know, 9 years ago, 10 years ago, with your first, you know, 240 acres, like imagine trying to buy 240 acres now. I mean, it's just, it's crazy to think what that would cost you now in comparison. I mean, obviously there's inflation and everything that to account for just regularly, but the real estate market, like you said, in Montana, I think in a lot of those kind of western states, Montana, Wyoming, down to Colorado, like it's through the roof.
Yeah,
it's a massive problem. I mean, it's not, you know, for the next generation of ranchers or farmers, access to stable, secure land is few and far between. There's just, it just doesn't exist like it used to. And so it's a real big concern for the future of our food security, for the future of open space and recreation and wildlife. And, you know, I don't know how many people know like how serious it is, because we in North America have, you know, the prairie is the most diverse ecosystem that we have, and it's only second to the Serengeti. So it's the number two most diverse ecosystem in the world, and we only have 1% of it left.
That's crazy.
And if we don't protect it, and we decide to build a large hotel or an amusement park or whatever it is in terms of development over it, it's lost, and you can't get it back. You know, part of our mission is preservation of what exists today. And and part of that preservation is only intact today because of ranchers that have stewarded that land for the last 100+ years. And so, you know, without those people, we wouldn't have open space, and we wouldn't have hunting, and we wouldn't have the type of recreation, and specifically in Montana, that we do today. So,
yeah. So, that's kind of like a perfect segue, right, to get into the conservation side of things. We mentioned it, or I mentioned it before, but, you know, Roam Free is the only 2% certified ranch that there is. So how is it that you guys first even learned about 2%?
I learned about it from a girl, a hunter we follow on Instagram. Old-fashioned way, social media.
It's a beautiful Jessie thing sometimes.
Johnson. Yeah, Jessie Johnson's her name, and we had just sent her some product to try. And, you know, we follow conservation hunters a lot. I just feel like we are aligned in a lot of our, you know, goals for wildlife and conservation. And she said, well, you should reach out because I think you guys are already doing it, you know. And so that's pretty much how we learned about you. And then, you know, things quickly went from there.
Yeah. Jessie is an absolute rock star. I had her on the podcast, Maybe 6 months ago. But yeah, she's a total badass, and she was super awesome to have on. So no, that's definitely whatever she's saying. I would certainly be listening.
Yeah.
So what are some of the organizations that you guys are working with that you're giving back to?
Most of the work that we do is right here locally in Hot Springs, Montana. So we, the whole project that we've taken on over the last 4 years is to take over conventionally raised operations, whether it's leasing it or purchasing it, and convert it to a regenerative operation. And the biggest part of that we've started with is building wildlife friendly fencing in the entire boundary of that property. So whereas most, you know, operations, especially with bison, may put up really tall fence that would restrict migration corridors of elk and deer, we actually build fence for it to come down instead of, you know, stand up to wildlife. So all of our work is around building that fence and then repairing it when the elk do migrate across it. And that's really the biggest project we have.
Yeah, that's the biggest one. Brittany also serves on the board of a organization called Western Sustainability Exchange. I'm on the board of the Montana Bison Association. You know, those are in their own way local programs here that we work through to, you know, Western Sustainability Exchange is all about making ranchers profitable to preserve open space for
wildlife,
hunters, recreation, et cetera, just keeping Montana the way it is. But they, you know, their whole organization is about how to keep ranchers on the land because they realize that's who's stewarding it. And when you have that, it's a good system when everybody shares in it. So, you know, we share our ideas in that as well. We put on a lot of workshops here at the ranch for people that want to get started in regenerative agriculture and or bison. We host so many people with that. But really our cash expenditure mainly is in a very large section of fence out here and where we're at in a very sensitive area between Missoula and Kalispell. So
yeah, and that's, I know the kind of that whole topic that you guys just talked about there with fencing and how it is a big problem for a lot of animals in their, you know, their migration corridor, you know, going from their summer to their winter range. I had some guests on a while back where they did this massive fence pull somewhere along the lines of like 10 miles a year. They were pulling or repairing old fence that were essentially hindering antelope from their corridor because for whatever reason, antelope won't jump over a fence. They try to go under it, get stuck, and it's a whole issue. So the fact that you guys have, you know, really taken that entire issue into consideration on, you know, the thousands of acres that you guys are, you know, branching on, it's incredible. I mean, that's just such a thing to be very aware of, and all the while knowing that, you know, there's going to be other animals on, you know, on your grounds, on your property, but making it as conducive for them to be able to, you know, pass through freely is awesome, and it's absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah, it's not always the most economical,
yeah.
But it is the right thing to do. I mean, it is a, you know, and like John said, I mean, it's not something that we say everybody, you know, everybody needs to do this or else, but it is something where we truly feel, especially in this area, you know, we'll have 400 elk on the property at any given time and sometimes more. It's important that they can still get back and forth and that we work with, you know, the native species. I mean, the whole concept of Roam Free really started from a way to bring back native species, and so working with the ones that are already here, I mean, I'm not even sure we had a conversation about it. It was just like, well, that's obviously what we're gonna do.
Yeah.
So yeah,
so what is, I guess, let's say, you know, maybe like the 3 to 5 year goal with Roam Free, and the fact that, you know, you've recently, you know, earlier this year, you know, launched some of your other products. I mean, what is kind of in store for the company, for the ranch?
Well, for the ranch side, if you want to talk about the food side, talk sure. about the ranch side, you know, we're always trying to grow the ranch. So we are always looking for new leases, which becomes more difficult, of course, every year and what we're just currently facing in the local environment here. So we're just trying to grow that land base out and continue to do that. The more we do that, the more security we have and the more is preserved. And time is of the essence. You know, it's just always a race against the clock to try to lock up more and more and more in a good way. Lock up in a good way.
Yeah.
That's really our goal. And of course, growing out the herd on that, swapping out all the fences, that is just a huge amount of work to continue that. And if all we do is just continue the trajectory of what we're doing, we will be very happy with that. Mm-hmm. So every little bit more that we can find, we keep building that way.
We want to be in a position when ranchers around us decide to sell their property that we can be financially able to either purchase it or lease it in a situation that makes sense for them, so that the only other option that they have is to sell it for economic development or some sort of build, that they have another option, that there's a rancher willing to take over their third or fourth generation ranch and preserve the heritage there. And, you know, for us, it's just setting ourselves up to be able to do that. On the food business, you know, we're really just trying to stay true to sort of the values of the brand originally, which is to make healthy food for people and not, you know, with that, bison is obviously one of the most nutrient dense proteins on the planet. It has all these other, you know, really big benefits, and making sure that we don't, you know, change that as we put it into different products. So keeping the integrity of the product there. And, you know, because somebody did ask me the other day, like, you know, what would you do if somebody offered you, you know, a buyout on Roam Free, like the food business? And I was like, I mean, John would just buy a bigger ranch. the same damn thing. So, you know, I mean, that's the whole point of the food business, was really to be able to save the ranch. And now it's to grow the ranch and be able to just impact more land and more wildlife. So more of the same.
Yeah, no, and that's, Brittany, you made a really good point there that, you know, as time goes on and you're able to grow bigger and, you know, build relationships with, you know, kind of surrounding ranches, that it's likely that there's, you know, going to come a time where they may look, maybe there's no one in the family that wants to, you know, be the next generation to run the ranch, and you know, they're left with a hard decision, right? To be able to keep, you know, land that's, you know, been in their family for, you know, generations, that while it may not be in their family, but to keep that land doing what it's been doing for so many years is a great thing. And, you know, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said just preserving that land for, you know, generations and generations to come, and not putting up, you know, another Whole Foods or Target or whatever the case is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's all sorts of competing interests for land. You know, some of the things you named, it could be timber, it could be mining, it could be, you know, a religion that wants to create, you know, a retreat out here. I mean, there's all sorts of different crazy things that happen and compete for land. And we're just trying to make sure that ranching is a viable option, you know, for the future.
Yeah, no, that's great. So just a few more things before I let you guys get out of here and enjoy your evenings. Do you guys even like have a chance or really an opportunity to kind of enjoy yourselves outside of the ranch? I mean, do you guys get to do any hunting or fishing or anything like that? I mean, gosh, you're in Montana, right?
Right.
Well,
not yet. No.
It depends what your version of enjoyment is. And you said hunting and fishing. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, we're doing that every day. I mean, do I get away and go out and go elk hunting? I really don't. I'm so super saturated in being outside 24/7 all day, every day, and really hunting the bison. I mean, every day is a hunt to just go find the herd and make sure they're in, you know. And then, of course, you know, we run hunts out here and sometimes I am hunting them through. So, yes, we do a lot of that. We fish, we do that all the time whenever we can after work. But Brittany would have a different opinion of what fun is. If it's going shopping, we don't do that a lot. So
yeah. No big Hawaii vacations anytime soon.
Yep.
Yeah. Brittany, how was that for you making that transition from, you know, Seattle, right? To kind of rural Montana.
Yeah. I mean, I was ready to do something different. I was going to move to like somewhere warm, you know, maybe a beach, maybe get some, you know, maybe Austin, Texas, who knows. I was, you know, that was the goal. And I just had no idea what Montana had to offer. And I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't want everybody moving here. But
yeah.
but honestly, I've never felt more grateful to be in a place in my entire life. I mean, especially with everything that's going on in the world and all of the change that's happened in the last couple of years. I mean, I truly do wake up every day and I feel grateful for the situation and just where I am. But I didn't know, you know, it was a leap of faith, I'll be honest. And good thing it worked out.
Yeah, sometimes the biggest risks offer the biggest rewards. And it certainly sounds like this has paid off for, you know, for both of you.
Absolutely, yeah.
So real quick, I can't let you guys get out of here without asking, where can people find your products?
Oh, yeah. So our website is goroamfree.com. And that's primarily where we sell all of our products. You can find our bison bites at all natural grocers starting in January, which is very exciting. And then you can find our chili and stew products in Costco starting in January in the Pacific Northwest.
Ah, you had me until you said Pacific Northwest.
Well, where are you located?
I'm in Michigan, so I'm like a lifetime away.
Darn. Well, Natural Grocers is where you'll find our bison bites, and always online.
yeah, that's what I'm gonna have to resort to that, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Well,
you never know. Give us a couple years. They got Costco's in Michigan.
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do. Well, I guess, you know, any closing thoughts, you know, before you guys get out of here?
You know, we're really excited to be part of the 2% conservation crew. And I was shocked that we were the only ranch. I was really, really shocked just because a lot of ranchers are just naturally doing conservation without calling it conservation. And so if anything, you know, to reach out, maybe I'll reach out to some of our ranching friends and let them know. But I mean, I honestly think that anybody doing a pasture raised operation is part of conservation in some way. And ranchers are really the last man standing out here in order to keep open space and wildlife available to everyone. So, just wanting to, you know, let everyone else know about it. So.
Yeah, very well said. Well, John, Brittany, thank you so much for your time this evening. I greatly appreciated it. I appreciate you answering all of my questions, however mundane they may have been, just because you deal with that stuff on a daily basis. You know, what you guys have built there is really, really cool. And I'm certainly excited to kind of see where the ranch goes in the future.
Yeah, thank you. We are too. And thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully we can get you guys on again and, you know, hear about maybe some new stuff that you have offering or how much the ranch has grown since today.
Yeah, awesome.
Sounds good.
All right, you guys take care.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You too.
All right. Well, thank you again to John and Brittany for joining me on the podcast today. I would also like to thank the partners of the podcast that helped make this possible: Wild Rivers Coffee, Stone Glacier, and Go Hunt, as well as 2% for Conservation. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast and help make it possible. And if you'd like to learn more about 2% for Conservation, you can visit their website, fishandwildlife.org, and there you can see all the certified brands that have committed to conservation that you should support when you shop. I also encourage you guys to follow 2% on social media, where they are going to post only positive conservation-driven content in your feed. So you'll certainly enjoy the daily dose of positivity from them. So again, if you'd like to learn more about 2% for Conservation, you can look for them online on social media or at fishandwildlife.org. Thanks for joining me this week, everyone. Stay tuned next week for another episode. And remember to stay safe out there, and that conservation starts with you.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.